Welcome to the Fuller Money Audio Commentary. This is David Fuller on Friday, the 22nd of June, recording at 9:42 p.m., and that's British Summer Time. Now, this being Friday, this is the big picture long-term outlook for the various asset classes, but first, let's have a quick review of the week. Well, in stock markets, it has been mostly to the upside, but we had that big downward dynamic on Wall Street yesterday, which wiped out most of the gains that we had seen earlier in the week. And Wall Street's closed a little bit firmer here today, with the S&P up 0.75% and the NASDAQ up 1.17%. In long-dated government bond prices, they have largely reined sideways, so yields would have done the same, but within a retreating pattern overall, and more on that in a moment. In other words, the bond yields had come down off the highs seen at the, the bond prices had come down off the highs seen at the beginning of this month. Now, in currencies, the U.S. dollar has remained reasonably firm overall within its trading ranges. I think the most interesting development in the currency arena is the recovery of the dollar against the Japanese yen. It's currently up to 80.46, and it's had some good upward dynamics recently. Precious metals, they were walloped yesterday, as you know, and there was some downside follow-through early today, although that was pegged back, and these markets actually closed, it looks like, mostly with modest gains. The most important one is gold, and in after-hours trading, that's up over $5 at 1571.5. Silver, which had traded lower early on, down as low as 2657, but it's at 2691.5 today. That's up 1.5 cents. Platinum still down a couple of dollars. Palladium recovered to be up a dollar here today. Crude oil bounced a little bit. We're right around the $90 level for Brent and the $80 level for WTI. Industrial metals, which have been drifting down really for quite some time, at least a few months, but copper. Copper was bucked that trend a tiny bit here today. Soft commodities, well, they've been moving on weather-related news for the most part, and grains and beans a little bit firmer here in the U.S. Okay, so what's going on here? Well, you know, it's been a choppy and volatile period, really, for quite some time in stock markets. We were in a corrective phase and saw quite a sharp reaction in May, and that gave way to, in the early days of June, that gave way to a technical rally, which has been reasonable, not least in some markets that had been out of favor in recent months. And those include India and Japan. But we've also seen depressed European markets steady overall. And that's going against the grain of sentiment generally. But sentiment at Fuller Money, at any rate, we regard as extremes of sentiment, we regard as important contrary indicators. And really, we've seen a riot of articles all talking about the breakup of the euro and that Greece was certain to exit and then the contagion would spread. And well, I don't need to repeat all that. You've You've heard it all before. Well, taking the view as I have all along that the euro is a political construct, this is really just a test of the wills and collective wills and resolve within the eurozone countries. We've got another meeting here this weekend. It must be seen like an endless stream of crisis meetings taking place within the eurozone. And this one involves France, Spain, and Italy meeting with Angela Merkel of Germany. And I'll be very interested to see how this turns out. But if European leaders were in any doubt as to the seriousness of the situation or what they needed to do about it, other world leaders, not to mention just about every editorial leader around the globe, has been telling them loudly and clearly. And I think sentiment is so negative that we, well, I think that there is as much scope now for upside risk, by that I mean some sort of successful additional steps or a faster move towards the fiscal integration that anybody who knows anything about currency unions has been saying was inevitable really from the start. So I think on a needs must basis, what I'm trying to say is that on a needs must basis, the pace of this European fiscal integration is likely to continue, and they are going to be more focused, I believe, on growth policies as well. Now, part of the reason for the uncertainty and confusion is that a massive game of chicken is being played here in terms of all the lobbying about just how much austerity we're going to have, what the terms are, how much additional support the ECB is going to provide relative to measures that need to be taken by governments themselves. All this is part of the rich ongoing cocktail here of debate and discussion, and that will really continue for some time. I wouldn't minimize the seriousness of the situation by any means, but again, debt problems are man-made and can be resolved by mankind as well. If we take the rest of the world, sorry, just to say, these European stock markets are arguably the most undervalued of any continent, and and there's some real value there. And if we take Europe stock markets plus all the concerns about the slowdown in Asia, and we are in a period where GDP growth has been synchronized in a slowdown phase. Well, let's just step that back. That's worrying, granted, but let's step back from that for a moment. And let's just hypothesize for a moment that you are arriving on the investment scene with some cash to invest after a long sabbatical. Now, would you arrive on the investment scene against an environment where growth had been declining, where economic concerns globally had been rising, and where central banks were increasingly talking about their willingness to do the right thing, whatever that means in central bank parlance, but for the most part it means accommodative monetary policy, whether it's more QE coming from the West for better or worse, or whether it's more of a stimulus which China and even India can afford. Against a background, I should add, of lower commodity prices. And those commodity indices, as you know, have been coming downwards since April 2011. So go back to my a hypothetical question. Would you rather be arriving on the investment scene with some cash against that background, which also includes record low government bond yields and some improvement in valuations as a result of the recent corrections, central banks becoming more accommodative, or would you rather arrive on the investment scene when stock markets are booming, when GDP growth is strong, and central banks are beginning to signal loudly and clearly their preference and need to raise interest rates to prevent overheating? Well, I know which environment I would choose, and it's the one we have here right now, which has hardly been ideal to live through. That's all the pain, but is leading to more stimulus, not least now from the growth economies, with the oil price considerably lower. The Reserve Bank of India certainly has scope to relax its monetary tightening policy further, and I think that's what we're going to see. So while markets continue to range, and with my technical background, I would continue to place a considerable amount of emphasis on the June reaction lows, those early June reaction lows. They are extremely important in terms of sentiment. And sentiment is such a crucial factor in stock markets, in any markets, in terms of both short and medium-term activity. So what I'm saying is that if those early June lows are exceeded, if they're taken out, then you can pretty well guarantee that sentiment's going to deteriorate further, that regardless of monetary stimulus, more investors are going to pull money out of the market, and those who can and are inclined to will leverage up their short positions. Conversely, if we consolidate in here, and I have mentioned recently, as is Owen, that we've gone from short-term oversold to short-term overbought on stochastic indicators. Those are very short-term. But we've talked about the need for a consolidation here. But if those lows hold and we then start to push higher again, then the catalyst could be additional stimulus from Chindia. It could be something that comes out of the euro. If people become more relaxed about the eurozone, that would represent a big change in sentiment overall, and we'll see more money going into stock markets. Now, I think this is fairly evenly balanced, but I'd give in terms of which direction these markets move over the next few weeks. But my hunch is the upside has at least a 50% chance of being the direction that markets take. And that will require a little bit of good news regarding monetary policy. And I think that's going to be forthcoming. And monetary policy is always the most significant fundamental factor in my investment thinking overall. And I think it's justified if you know your market history. Okay. Now, what about these long-dated government bonds? Well, let's think what happened prior to the beginning of this month. Bond yields were going down as fear was rising during the sell-off in global stock markets. The bond prices, therefore, were moving higher in a steady, strong sweep that actually accelerated somewhat in the last days of May. As the stock market rally started in early June, we saw some downward reactions across the boards in these long-dated government bond prices, and they were sharper than downward reactions that we had seen during the previous at least 2 months. So in other words, they checked the momentum. And subsequently, we've had bond prices ranging sideways. So just think of that picture. You can visualize this, and of course you can check it out in the library. A steady rise for at least 2 months with some acceleration towards the end. A sharper reaction than we had seen previously during the rise. And now moving sideways. A little bit of a type 1-ish top with some right-hand extension showing in that action. And the inverse upside-down mirror image of that will be evident in the bond yields if you look at them on sensitive charts. Now, steadier action in stock markets in the next week or two could easily lead to a downward break in those bond prices. They look overextended, they've lost upside momentum, and I think that's at least a 50-50 chance that we will see those bond prices come down somewhat, and therefore the yields move a bit higher. I think there's little doubt that bond yields are really priced for a worst case outlook. Worst case outlooks are often talked about, but materialize less frequently, fortunately. I think it's at the end of that long 30-year plus bull market that we've seen, and by the bull market I mean the decline, that long decline in yields, the flip side of which is the long advance in government bond prices. Yes, we've still got the QE programs that can keep them higher in the West for a while longer, but Euro concerns, European concerns have certainly given them an extra push that we might not have seen otherwise. So what I'm saying, and I appreciate that I'm saying this not for the first time, but I think that we're very, very close to the end. And mathematically, there really isn't much further that some of those long-dated yields can actually decline. I commented yesterday on those Swiss five-year bond yields. Now, of course, Switzerland is not in the in the Eurozone, although the Swiss franc is pegged to the euro. And that's, I mentioned that those five-year yields had moved below zero. Now that certainly rings a few bells in terms of being a bit of a contrary indicator. I'm assuming, and this seems a fairly obvious point, that some people who've been holding peripheral debt in the Eurozone have come out of that, and because they're worried about a breakup, whether it's just Greece, and really, if I were a betting man, I would say that Greece probably will, almost certainly will, exit the euro at some stage, but not immediately. Or might it be Spanish government debt, where the chances of seeing where the chances of seeing a haircut for bondholders has certainly increased in recent months. So some of that money has flown into the Swiss bond market and other bond markets around the world that are regarded as more acceptable. And then I think also another explanation, which I didn't mention yesterday, but I was thinking about earlier today when it occurred to me, is that buying those Swiss government bonds at zero or below zero yields, while that doesn't seem very smart from a financial position, it can be defended perhaps as a cheap call option on the prospects of a breakup of the Eurozone. Now, I don't think that's going to happen, barring the exclusion of Greece, barring the Grexit at some stage. But plenty of other people are more pessimistic about what happens to the euro, and so thus the potential appeal for some of these people of those 5-year Swiss bonds as I described it, as a cheap call option on a wider area, a European breakup. It's not a trade that I would put on, but I can understand it. I would rather be investing in dividend aristocrat type shares. We say this, we sound like a broken record in saying this, and have for the last year. And while some of those shares have done reasonably well, they've also been raising yields, and they are raising, increasing dividends, I should say, which has been raising the yield, or keeping it from falling that much. And we also like the autonomies. Those have been the best performing sectors, and I think that will remain the case, probably until confidence really does pick up quite significantly. Now, none of us are expecting that to happen overnight. It will happen. If sentiment is largely negative, you've pushed the pendulum pretty far in one direction, and it eventually does work its way back in the other direction. But when that happens, when confidence does improve significantly, then I think we'll see a lot of smaller cap stocks start to do quite well by comparison. So we want to watch for that transition, but I doubt that it's actually imminent, although, as you can see, I'm certainly not all that bearish in terms of the overall outlook for stock markets, and I do think we'll see higher levels by year end, and that would include the Eurozone stock markets as well. Okay, what about the U.S. dollar? Well, reasonably steady overall. I mentioned that the most interesting thing, as far as I'm concerned, is a weaker tone in the yen. You might have seen the piece that Owen posted yesterday pointing out that Prime Minister of Japan, Mr. Noda, that the Diet had voted his candidates onto the board of the Bank of Japan. So basically, this is something that I've described previously as a policy to isolate Mr. Shirakawa. He's the governor of the Bank of England and will remain governor until April 6th of next year. But the more they isolate him, the more they are able to influence a change in monetary policy. And what Owen and I have been saying for a long time here is that we expect and want to see a lower yen as a catalyst for some selling of JGBs, and also, more importantly, a stronger rally or sustainable rally in the Japanese stock market, which many people also regard as quite attractive on a valuation basis. So I mentioned in my introduction that the Japanese stock market, having rallied all the way up at the beginning of the, well, having had a very good rally at the beginning of the year, then came all the way back down, and it's in the last 3 weeks, it's been a relative outperformer in here. And as long as this yen keeps weakening, and its dollar yen is currently 80.44, I think we can easily see further gains in the Japanese stock market, provided Wall Street and the other leading indices don't take out those June lows, which I regard as a high risk, but less than 50%, a significant risk, but less than 50%. Okay, what about precious metals? Well, I was unnerved yesterday by the very sharp decline that we saw in gold and silver. And because I have talked about precious metals as most likely being in a support building phase, marking the transition from distribution, a lengthy period of distribution, going back to the peaks that we saw in gold and silver last year. Silver peaked earlier in April of 2011, gold in August and September. And because they became overextended on the upside, those trends accelerated up and away from their rising 200-day moving averages. It was not a difficult call to make at that stage that they were overextended and due for at least a mean reversion reaction. And when you get real overextensions, this has happened so often in the past, you don't just get mean reversion to the MA, you go below it. And that's what we've actually seen. And this is reminiscent to at least a couple of other accelerated advances and the lengthy, approximately 18-month reactions and consolidations that we've seen before the secular bull trend ended. So my hunch and also hope, because I was backing that hunch and still am to a lesser extent, that we were transforming here from the distribution stage when people are taking profits to the accumulation stage when people are moving back into gold. And once that reestablishes at least a clear short-term uptrend, then I think that market psychology being what it is, people would say that gold is once again performing as a haven, not just as a risk-on asset, which has been the case for a good 8 or 9 months. Now, excuse me, as I said, yesterday's sharp sell-off in gold and particularly in silver have questioned that contention. They haven't negated it, and I'm relieved not to have seen any significant follow-through here today. We had some early follow-through, but it did not hold. Now, we haven't had anything like a countermanding move to the upside, but that will actually be required. In other words, we need to see gold in particular find support above its lows that we saw last month and continue to range in a steady fashion, eventually moving up the high above the highs that we'd seen last week. So that's what's required. And while I would certainly like to see that happen, and I think there's a reasonable chance that will happen, as I said, I don't want to, I'm repeating myself, it's been questioned. Let's move on to crude oil. I think on my wish list several months ago, when crude oil was overextended on the upside and just running out of momentum, showing signs that a reaction was occurring, I said to get a genuine reset, my wish list would include the Brent crude coming back to about the $80 region and the Brent crude coming back to about the $90 region and WTI coming back to about the $80 region at least. Well, we've seen that. We saw that yesterday, and they're hovering right around those levels. We have seen a bit of downward acceleration by crude, so we're short-term oversold. I wouldn't be at all surprised if we didn't see some loss of downside momentum, a little above, a little below that $80 level for the WTI and that $90 level for the Brent. That's what I actually expect, but I can't overemphasize the importance of this move downwards. Yes, it indicates slower GDP growth and therefore less consumption of crude oil, but it also indicates a reversal of what were big speculative positions earlier in the year when crude oil was up near its highs, And I was saying that, well, I could see it on the chart, but I thought there was a good deal of speculation involved in all of that, and that it wasn't demand driven. Now, I think to get oil back up to those levels would require another significant version of the Arab Spring, in other words, causing widespread fears of. Of a significant decrease in production, or it would require some sort of covert action, military action, or not so covert, dramatic military action against Iran, against Iran's nuclear installations. That's a risk. But I think it would take something extreme like that, really to push crude back up in a meaningful way. Because having wrung out a fair amount of the speculation, there will need to be a catalyst to bring it back. I don't think that demand will pick up until we pull out of this synchronized global economic slowdown, and I hope we pull out of that before the end of the year, and I think that's not an unreasonable possibility, given sufficient monetary stimulus by the China-led growth economies. But what's also taking place is that the government-subsidized programs, which we've seen to produce renewables, now these are of course driven by concerns over global warming, but also the fears over runaway oil prices that led to the spikes in 2008 and again in 2011 and earlier this year. So, as I say, that's spurred the development of these renewables, of which, in my opinion, solar is by far the most flexible and the most viable. When I say flexible, there are solar panels on the individual houses, and there are great solar panel farms in some less populated and extremely hot, sunny regions of the globe. But all along, this clock is ticking in which these renewable technologies not only improve but are more widely utilized. And this is a process that's certainly not going to change. This will continue for quite a long time. And then an even bigger factor is, of course, the fracking revolution, the U.S. invention, which has transformed, literally, as we said it would, the U.S. oil picture. And this technology is going to be adopted around the world over the next many years, and therefore we're going to see an increase in the supply of crude oil, making OPEC certainly less influential, making Russia less influential in the energy market. There's a lot more natural gas out there to be produced, a lot more crude oil in the form of, they call it unconventional oil, in the form of shale. There's plenty of this stuff. It can last well through the end of this century. So we're going from a long period where people were concerned about peak oil, talking about peak conventional oil, and that started even before there was any viable technology for extracting the shale. But on a needs-must basis, that's happened, and that's a very good thing as well. And that is a key reason why Fuller Money remains convinced that we will see lower energy prices in real terms in the next decade than we have seen in recent years. And that will be very good for long-term global GDP growth. And on that note, folks, I think I've run on long enough. Have a great weekend. All the best.